Good evening, everybody. Good evening. It's an enormous pleasure to see you all here this evening, and I'm delighted the room is so full. It's a very big room. You'd know if it was empty. And it's a real pleasure to see so many of you this evening. And I know from looking at some of the faces around the room, I know that some of you have been able to stay for various of the proceedings that we've had earlier on today as well. We've had a truly remarkable day, actually. Slightly depressing from my point of view. A lot of Brexit, more Brexit to come. But I think what we have really begun to do is just show how complex this set of issues that have been unleashed really is, and how difficult the unpicking is going to be. But more on that to come. So this is my opportunity really to welcome you as alumni. I'm currently have the wonderful privilege, actually, of being interim director at the LSE. So I'm a professor in the law department by background, and I became pro-director for research, which in the LSE speak is actually a contradiction in terms, because you don't ever direct any LSE's academic research. So really what that involves is managing, nurturing, helping people, finding funding for, facilitating research, and then helping people get that research out into the non-academic environment. The non-academic environment, gosh, how jargon-ridden is that? But making sure that research can go out and really make an impact is my main responsibility, which I've been doing since 2014. And then I took on the role of interim director in September 2016, this year. Seems longer ago than that, has to be said. And I'll hold this role until our new director comes in 2017, and that is Dame Manoush Shafiq, who is currently Deputy Director at the Bank of England, so she's quietly busy as well at the moment, one or two things on. But we are looking forward to welcoming her back to the LSE. She is an LSE alumnus. She did an economics MSc with us in 1986, I think it was, and I know she regards the LSE very much as her home, as it were, her intellectual home. So that's my role at the moment. And I've been doing increasing number of alumni events, actually, in both roles. And I also, when I was in the law department, I helped manage our lawyers' alumni group. We have our own alumni group in the law department, always do things slightly differently there. And I'm always enormously impressed, actually, by the enthusiasm, the dedication and the sheer spirit of the LSE alumni. And, you know, nobody asks people to volunteer to be alumni. Nobody asks people to spend their evenings going through mailing lists and databases and emailing things out and organising venues and doing this, that and the other. But people do it. And it's a fantastic role that people play when they do that. And it does provide a wonderful opportunity for LSE alumni to get together. It provides wonderful networking opportunities, and it can be a huge source of support. I was just talking to some of the alumni volunteers, actually, before I came in this evening, in particular to the Belgian volunteers. Where are they? They must be here somewhere. And I was asking what they were over there. What kind of things do you do? And I was astonished. What is it, 24 events a year on average? Of different types of varieties, you know, obviously people coming through town, some people staying for longer than others, as is the nature of jobs. But just the role that the alumni network plays in helping people feel at home when they first arrive somewhere they don't know anybody, helping maintain connections, and also just helping to give a little bit of difference or vibrancy or intellectual life away from one's work and away from the normal networks that one has. So I do think that the alumni associations that we have, so many of them around the world, are rather wonderful things, actually, wonderful social phenomena. And it also, as I was saying to the alumni volunteers earlier on this afternoon, that being around our alumni, and to be honest, Brexit itself, has made me realise just how much I had accepted as completely and utterly normal how global an institution the LSE is. So I've been there since 1994, as I said, or might have said, and for me it has just become completely par for the course that I would have a room probably of a number of students of more or less this number, could be more, could be less, and I would probably easily have about 60 different nationalities in that room. in any lecture theatre. And I was also joking for some master students coming on some courses, then you play a game called Hunt the Brit, okay? Because there are so few, particularly on master's level. For our student body, we have over 68% of our students across both postgrad and undergrad are non-UK. Of those at postgrad, around a third are from the EU. Of our academic faculty, we have around 35-38% of our academic faculty are from the EU, the non-UK EU. We have, even on our professional services staff, we have about 25% of our professional services staff are EU. And I suddenly realised as I was sitting up here introducing speaker after speaker today, that of all the different speakers that I introduced, of all the different LSE academics, I was actually the only Brit sitting up there on the panel. And I wasn't even presenting in academic capacity. But I hadn't even thought about it, never even crossed my mind. And I think that's wonderful, actually, that I've never had to think about it, because it really did has driven home to me in the last few months, actually, how important that international diversity, that openness is for the LSE as an institution. That's who we are. That's what we are. And a keynote speaker that we had after lunch, Ruta Hubner, was talking about the threat to the values of openness, liberalism, diversity. I would add upholding the rule of law on that as a lawyer, and how those are under threat in different ways, in different countries. And once things are under threat, then you suddenly realise how much you've been taken for granted. And I think this is an incredibly important time for us as the LSE, because you all are still part of the LSE, to be standing firm and saying, well, actually, no, we do. This is what we do value. We value that internationalism. We value the global diversity that has and is the LSE community. So I really do take my hat off to you, metaphorically, obviously, for the work that you do in keeping the LSE alive, okay, outside of Houghton Street and outside of buildings that have now been knocked down that, you know, but will be rebuilt again, don't worry, in newer and better ways, but keeping the LSE alive in that way. We're here to celebrate a significant part of the LSE, the European Institute. The European Institute was founded 25 years ago. This is where this one starts to feel old in different ways. And the European Institute is a truly interdisciplinary research centre, department within the school. It has members range from economists to anthropologists, with pretty much everything in between, even the odd lawyer. It has fantastic research, even the odd lawyer, they're very odd. It has a great research reputation. You know, our REF exercises, the UK government likes to assess everything in any way it possibly can, and it assesses our research on a periodic basis. Came, you know, top of its own league table within that. But it also shares the fundamental of the mission of the LSE, which is public engagement and to be there for the betterment of society. So I'm delighted that we're able to celebrate the European Institute's 25th anniversary with you today. LSE and Brexit, we've always got to look for new opportunities. And I think that, you know, if Brexit's done anything, it's made the European Institute even more relevant than it was before in terms of really trying to understand what the future both is going to be, both for the EU and for the UK and the interrelationships between the two. I spend a lot of my time in Whitehall at the moment talking about the need to stand up for higher education and the role that higher education plays in embodying, as I say, those values of diversity, also a little bit of economic growth, should we put in there. But I think one of the things that we are realising today is the impacts of Brexit are going to be multitudinous, and we're only beginning to start to compile, as I've been saying to people, only beginning to start to compile the to-do list of what's to be done, let alone get on with doing it. So I'm now going to hand over to the panel for Kevin to kick off.
Thank you.
I'm sure we'll have a thriving debate.
Thank you for that, Julia, and it's great that you can be with us at our 25th birthday party. Of course, when the European Institute was established 25 years ago, need I say that I wasn't even at university. I was a mere strapping child at school. In fact, I wasn't even born 25 years ago. Moving on. Thank you for the kind words about the European Institute. It is a great role to be the head of the European Institute at this particular time. The Institute continues to have a very collegial, very friendly atmosphere. We're known within the school for that friendliness, collegiality. We also, as Julia has said, have fantastic scholars in the Institute for research and teaching. And cometh the hour, cometh the European Institute, we are indeed very relevant to the current agenda for Britain and for Europe. I know that there are a number of European Institute alumni here in the audience, and I'm delighted that you've been able to join us. Some of you graduated from the European Institute some time ago. I think if you were to come back to the European Institute, you'd see a number of familiar faces. I can mention perhaps just a few: Nicholas Barr, Bob Hanke, Valtrad Schelkel, Abby Innes. These are people I think have taught you over the years and are still teaching our students today. So we have continuity, but we also have renewal. Julia's mentioned that the LSE campus, in part, is a building site at the moment. It's okay. They're building the new offices of the European Institute. A very worthwhile investment, let me add. So we have continuity, but we have renewal. We will be appointing two new academics to join the European Institute for the next academic year. And we are responding to the agendas of the challenges for the European Union, challenges of migration, the euro debt crisis, etc. So it leads us now to our 25th anniversary panel discussion. Who would have imagined 25 years ago that we would be commemorating the 25th anniversary of the European Institute by talking about Brexit? Mamma mia. But we are. And we're talking about Brexit, of course, in the context of a set of different crises, a confluence of unprecedented crises affecting the European Union. In some respects, these crises have a salience and an importance which affects member states in very different ways, whether it's a debt crisis or migration, Euroscepticism, challenges to the public support for the European Union. These are crises that are not uniform across the European Union, but I guess they do come together to challenge, to question the very purpose, the coherence of today's European Union. So tonight we will be looking at the impact of Brexit on the European Union as we go forward, and we'll be looking at both the economics and the politics. I'm delighted to welcome my colleagues. For this 25th anniversary European Institute panel, we're delighted to host a colleague from the government department, Tony Travers, at the far end of the table here, Jennifer Jackson-Priest, Paul de Grauwe, and Ian Begg. We're going to have a discussion which will cover the economics and the politics across the two dimensions, the economic implications for the UK, the economic implications for the European Union, questions of political impact and new kinds of political participation, activism, and the impacts of Brexit on domestic British politics. So we will try to cover the full territory. We will make sure, in good LSE tradition, that we allow plenty of time for your comments and questions from the audience afterwards. And bear with us, there is a prize. At the end of this particular panel discussion, you're going to be offered drinks and cocktails in the reception outside. So there is every reason to listen to LSE academics once more. We will follow the sequence of speakers as listed in your programme. So I'm going to call upon first Ian Begg to start us off looking at the economic implications of Brexit for the UK. Thank you very much.
Well, good evening, everybody. And in good academic tradition, I'm going to ignore the instructions I've been given and talk about what I want to talk about, which is not just the implications for the UK, but just to touch on those that affect the rest of the EU. Now, I want to go beyond what Kevin just said about the crises, because we know that there are various crises around. Just to enumerate them, we have the fact that the euro is still in trouble. It hasn't been fully resolved yet. That is going to have real complications when we start to talk about the next steps, which are involved in putting into place the proposals put forward in the Five Presidents' report. They've already almost got lost in the traffic already. Do we have a fiscal union or not? For example of that sort of question. We have the challenge of the migrants and what that may well imply for Schengen. Can Schengen survive this wave of migrants that's already arrived and the possibility of far more migrants arriving in future? Terrorism, it hasn't gone away. It's going to keep coming back to us and requires both security responses and social responses. And at the same time, our leaders are having to contend with the fact that because of the lack of growth in the European Union, there is social distress. There are social difficulties which are not being addressed effectively by some of you in your day jobs. That, in turn, is one of the drivers of populism, but by no means the only one, but it's one of the significant ones. And add to all of this, you get these difficult Brits coming in. Oh, it's him. Now, what sort of challenges surround Brexit? Well, the first is, and I've given innumerable talks over the last 18 months on this, and I have to start just about everyone with these two words. It depends. We don't know. We're not being told. And the problem with that is that some of the things that have been canvassed, such as, yes, a great idea, well, all we need to do is forget about the European Union, we'll go over to emerging markets. We can sell our exports there instead. And you can see some of the statistics here. Would you really believe it? That the UK exports more to Ireland and China. Well, it's a fact. That we export more to Sweden than two of the other BRICS, Brazil and India. These are the hard facts that underlie this rather pompous debate that goes on in London about, yeah, well, we can switch. We don't need to bother about the EU anymore. And then we also have to recognise that interpreting the decision that voters made, they were given a binary choice, in or out, leave, remain. And yet all this superstructure has been put on it. What they were really voting for was against migration, or they were against paying into the EU, or they were against the European Court of Justice, or they wanted to take back control of all sorts of things. A binary vote is being interpreted in multiple ways, which is very hard to do realistically. And there's been a new expression has come out in London over the last few weeks, the jams. Everybody familiar with it? The jams? The just about managings. They're the new virtuous group that all policy has to target. So if you have a trouble, as they say in French, to boucler les fins de mois, then you're a jam. So think of yourself. Are you jams or not? But then I'm going to quote to you a prominent French economist who says that, yes, there are challenges for Britain, but it's equally a major challenge for the rest of the European Union. And we have to keep that in mind, because the Brexit debate in the UK is almost exclusively about what Britain wants and not what the other side wants. Now, to touch on the economic arguments, there was a huge amount of material produced during the referendum campaign, including by academics, my fellow academics at LSE in the Centre for Economic Performance, which tried to argue that depending on what assumptions you made about the trade and investment, there would be a GDP loss, somewhere between 2% and 9% GDP loss relative to what would otherwise have happened. And it's important to stress that clause. If you project over 15 years, the economy might have grown by, let's say, 30%, 2% per annum roughly. Instead, it may grow by 28% or 21%. That's the scale of the GDP loss that's projected. this comes about because of a less favourable trade regime, maybe some reduction in incentives for investment. That's the explanation behind these projections. But what we also have, if that is the result, lower GDP compared with otherwise, it means fewer jobs. It also means the public finances deteriorate. Yes, Britain will save by no longer paying its net contribution to the EU budget. But if GDP is lower, tax revenue is lower, and that aggravates the existing public finance position. So that too becomes part of the story. The short term, there was a very significant report produced by the Treasury just before it went into purdah during the referendum. In other words, a month before the referendum, saying that the UK economy ought already to be in recession. It was going to have recession in the first two quarters that followed the Brexit decision. That was predicated on the famous Article 50 being triggered immediately, but it was also explained as being due to uncertainty, which we've certainly seen, to problems of financial instability, which we've also seen with the ups and downs of the stock market and the pound. There was also a suggestion that once you enter the transition, which maybe hasn't started yet, then things would also change. So these are the explanations behind the Treasury vote, the Treasury judgment. Now, what we've seen since then is a lot of disagreement about whether that short-term effect really was temporary, a few weeks, happened in July, and then bounced back in August, or whether it hasn't yet started because we haven't triggered Article 50. See what I mean? It depends. Since then, what have we seen? Well, the economy so far has been pretty resilient. We had almost exactly the same growth rate in the third quarter as was projected in the March budget when the last projections were published before the referendum. What we don't yet see is whether over the next 2 years, the latest figures suggest that from the Office for Budget Responsibility, suggest that there will be lower growth over the next 2 years than would otherwise have been. Now, that's still the transition effect. It's not true Brexit of having left. And what you see as well is that there is yet to be much effect of the lower pound on inflation in the UK. It's just starting to happen. You see signals that inflation may be picking up. And if that does happen, and in the absence of wage increases, real incomes will be eroded. The famous pound in the pocket will be devalued, to quote a long-ago Prime Minister of Britain. There's also been an estimate from the Office for Budget Responsibility that the public finance cost of Brexit will be of the order of £12 billion per annum. This was Robert Choate, its executive director, telling the House of Commons Treasury Committee this is what he expected. And that, as you can see here, exceeds the net membership fee that the UK pays to the EU. Also, we cannot ignore the fact that the EU's economies are also going to be at risk because the uncertainty works there as well. It has effects on confidence. It's going to make it far more difficult for investment decisions to be sorted out. This is all these kinds of cumulative effects that go on. And that means that there's also going to be some offsetting because we know that some companies, some financial intermediaries are going to relocate at least part of their activity away from the UK towards other continental centres. And yet, if you consider the financial service industry, what's more likely is that those companies will migrate not to Frankfurt or Paris, but to New York or to Singapore. So it's a loss for Europe as a whole that we had to contemplate here. And the risk is that the economy resilient so far will simply fall off a cliff. Now, do any of you remember the Roadrunner cartoon with Wile E. Coyote? This is what we're at risk of having. You're running around the edge of the cliff and then, whoops, the ground's gone beneath you. So I see risks here which have not really started to affect the UK economy. And we don't yet know for certain whether the small tribe of economists for Brexit was correct and all the rest were wrong, including the Centre for Economic Performance, or whether we're still waiting to see what happens next. This brings me to, I'm going to go from dilemma to trilemma and then quadrilemma. The dilemma, what does the UK want? Well, much has been bandied around. We've heard about the UK wanting access to the single market, except the others say, well, if you want access to the single market, why should we give you goodies? This is where the UK debate hasn't really cottoned onto the fact that there's a counterparty to this negotiation. Because we also want to get rid of budget costs, and we want to stop all these foreigners coming into the UK. The ones that we enjoy, that Julia hires, and the students that we teach. We want to stop them. Makes sense, doesn't it? But you can't have lower budget costs, the single market, and a curb on free movement. Why not? Because Angela Merkel says nine. And she's not the only one. There's also been bandied around from Michel Barnier, not officially published yet, a figure that the divorce settlement bill, once Article 50 is sorted out, could be as high as 60 billion euros. It's enormous, isn't it? Enormous figure, compared even with the 12 billion I just mentioned as the fiscal cost to the UK. Now, I've tried, because I was approached by a couple of journalists about this the other day, to work out where Barnier could have got his 60 billion from. Here's my attempt at an answer. The EU budget is set in a seven-year framework, and within that framework, there's annual budgets. The gross amount that the UK is expected to pay, as you can see here, is of the order of 19 to 20 billion. Once you take off the UK rebate, which is always taken off, so it's automatic, it goes down to maybe 15 billion. And then you have the net payment, which results in UK receiving money from the EU budget of the order of 6 to 7 billion per annum. So these are figures you could use. If you take the top one, the 20 billion, over 2 years, that's 40 billion of Barnier's 60. Then you have one of these wonderful Brussels expression, le reste à liquider, or RAL for short, which is the accrued amounts due to be paid, for example, to Polish economic development projects, because they've been very slow to start, or to professors at the London School of Economics on five-year European Research Council grants, which start today and go on till 2021. These will have to be liquidated beyond the end of the budget period. There, the total RAL, estimated in 2015, for 2015, was of the order of 218 billion, all the amounts still to be paid. Now, that will diminish a bit as the seven-year framework goes on, but not necessarily. Take a UK share of that, you could arrive at a figure of 26 billion. Then you have other things. The UK nationals working for European institutions are of the order of 4% now, but the number of pensioners is 8%. Should there be an indefinite commitment by the UK to pay UK nationals who are pensioners? We don't know. Relatively small amount. You have loan guarantees. The Juncker plan, which you're all familiar with, is something that demands guarantees. Suppose those guarantees are cold. That could be a lingering demand on the UK. And even something obscure, which I've become aware of, is the European emissions trading system, which includes, from the revenue that raises, a standard payment going to the countries of Central and Eastern Europe, stretching out to 2021, and with negotiation of the next phase of ETS due from 2021 onwards. Still more could be paid. So, what happens? If Barnier comes along and says the bill for leaving is 60 billion, what does Britain do? Pay it? Well, that will cause the Daily Mail's headlines generating machine to explode. Renege on it. And say to the EU, we're leaving anyway, sue us, we don't care, you're not getting the money. The money is where there's going to be a major challenge in the Brexit negotiations. And here's another part of the money. Many of you saw this promise emblazoned on the red bus. £350 million per week were going to come back to be spent on the NHS. So that's the promise to the British voters. But that has a counterpart. It means it's no longer available to the EU budget. And what's that going to do? Well, it's going to mean somebody else has to pay. And I've done the back of the envelope calculation on this. The somebody else, if it were the 12 countries that joined in 2004 and 7, it's more or less the same amount. They would have to double their payment to offset the British one. That wouldn't happen that way because they'd ask the Germans. But the Germans are under pressure from Alternative für Deutschland, so they won't want to pay. Crisis. Then you have negotiation of the next round of this. Always very difficult. That's going to be fraught. Unless the UK pays a bit, which would mean breaking the promise. And in any case, the money's going to be less available. The whole lot is a toxic mix, isn't it? Now, you don't see this in the press very much yet, except maybe in the FT. But this is another big challenge. So I draw from this three awkward implications. The first is we need to work quickly, and yet we don't seem to be able to do so. And that's going to upset the UK as a specialist entity. It's going to slow investment. Second, promises have been made which simply cannot be delivered. That is going to risk a political backlash. And third, there's a strong risk that the Brexit economic deal will be lose-lose for both sides because activity goes elsewhere, because of renewed financial instability, and also perhaps because other countries fearful of Brexit or populist processes are going to say, we'll slow down on them. So I leave you with the words of Vladimir Ilyich Lenin, obviously, who said this: there are decades where nothing happens and there are weeks where decades happen. And if you want to go further on this, here are two websites I commend to you. Thank you.
Thank you, Ian, for getting us off to an excellent start. Paul.
I'm very pleased to be here with my colleagues to be able to discuss with you issues that have to do with Brexit, and I will take the view or the position of the European Union and ask a number of questions. I would like to start asking the question, how should we organize Brexit from the point of view of the European Union, right? That's the point of view that I want to take. And then the second question will be, what's the future of the European Union after Brexit? And I will also take mainly an economic perspective. So let me start with the first question. And first of all, I would like to put it as follows with another question, which is, what should be the objective of the EU in the negotiation that will lead to Brexit? Right? And here my answer is, the objective should be to maintain the integrity of the European Union. And the integrity of the European Union is essentially the integrity of a model where member countries have transferred their national sovereignty in a number of areas to EU institutions. And these areas are mainly trade and internal markets. So basically that's a model where nation states have been willing to transfer part of their sovereignty to European institutions. That's also a model where majority rule prevails, right? You are sometimes in the minority and you have to accept decisions that have been made at the level of the European institutions. So it's also a model where we do not accept veto powers. Now, Brexit has been a vote on sovereignty where a majority of British citizens have decided that they want to take back control over borders, over their border, over the law, and over their money. In other words, they want full sovereignty, right? And of course, that clashes with that model, right? And that does not leave much space to come to an agreement, right? We can, of course, turn around this and try to evade all this, but the punchline is that the UK has decided to be fully sovereign. And as a result, the number of options that are possible for the UK are extremely limited, right? And are not the options that are sometimes put forward. In particular, this means that access to the internal market has become impossible, right? Because internal market means some transfer of sovereignty. Right? And if you have decided we don't want to transfer sovereignty, we don't want to accept a majority rule that would sometimes put us in a minority position, then access to the internal market has become impossible. You can still dream, and sometimes people try to find out whether there are something, some options in between, but essentially there are none, except to be treated as a sovereign nation. And in other words, the EU institutions and the important political authorities in the European Union should make it clear that there is, in fact, only one option. That is that the UK, once it has exited from the European Union, will be treated like other sovereign nations, like the US, like Japan, Canada, and therefore we'll have to come to an agreement, a trade agreement, free trade agreement, and hopefully as free as possible to continue to develop relations with the European Union. That, in fact, should be made very clear from the start so that there are no illusions about this, right, that something else can be achieved. I think this signal should be made very clear. It's also important for the future of the European Union. If we don't do that, right, then we, in fact, create a signal for the others that says, well, there are possibilities to get something else. You can take back some of your sovereignty and still have full access to the internal market. It's all possible. In other words, that would mean a deconstruction of the European Union. And I think we should keep in mind that integrity of that model should be maintained, and we should do everything we can to avoid that all this, that Brexit leads to a deconstruction of the European Union. So that, I think, is the strategy that should be followed, but it's not going to be easy because on both sides, not only in the UK, but also in the European Union, there are forces trying to achieve something else. And in particular, in the European Union, this is the export lobby. We export, the European Union exports more to the UK than the UK exports towards the European Union. And that creates, of course, a force, also a political force, to try to come and to achieve a deal that is somewhere else than the one that have put forward. And I think we should resist that because it's not good for the integrity of the European Union. And if we do that, I think we can, in fact, come to relations with the UK that will lead to minimal economic disruption. And sometimes people have said, well, if the UK is not in the internal market, this will be terrible for the UK. I don't think so. We can achieve trade deals that allow the UK to continue to be prosperous and the EU likewise. So I think an agreement can be achieved, but these principles that I have spelled out should, I think, be maintained. Let me now turn to the second question that I wanted to discuss with you, and that has to do with the future of the EU after Brexit. Right? In a way, you could say that Brexit has created a potential for further integration in Europe. Why do I say that? Well, I consider the UK to have been a force that has opposed further integration, right? And in fact, sometimes has even tried to deconstruct it. That is, deconstruct the model of majority rule and try to move in the direction of intergovernmentalism that allows each country to avoid having to transfer sovereignty. So not having this partner in your house that really wants to deconstruct the house makes life a little easier. So, and creates a potential for further integration. But I don't want to exaggerate that either, because with the remaining member countries, there are also quite a lot, there are also forces that refuse to go forward. And as a result, we should probably not think today of taking Brexit as the way or the potential to integrate further. There is one exception, though, that I want to mention here, and that is in the Eurozone. There, it's very clear that if we do not go forward into political and budgetary integration, then this whole project is doomed, right? The euro is a currency without a country, and if we don't want to create a country, it will just not survive. So, but that's very independent from Brexit, right? We created that project, and Whether or not the UK is in the European Union doesn't make a difference there. We will have to move forward there in the group of countries that form the monetary union. We will have to go forward in the direction of political and budgetary union. Otherwise, before the next celebration of 25 years, we will have to look back to that experiment that has ended. But again, this is independent of Brexit. We will have to move forward. So, but let me return to the European Union then, and then say the following: before we attempt to move forward with more integration, we should try to fix what does not work in the European Union. So let me concentrate on that one, on the things that do not work well, and that create situations where, in the political domain, we could have similar votes of no confidence in the whole project. The fundamental problem, it seems to me, is that the EU has become, or is at least perceived to be, a vehicle through which globalization has achieved its full force within Europe, right? Trade and integration has been the dynamics that has worked at the EU level and that has unleashed forces of globalization within Europe. And that's a very positive force, right? There is no doubt that this has made it possible for Europe to grow and to achieve material welfare as it has never before. So this is a essentially positive force. But of course, there are two problems that we have to face today, right? The first problem has to do with the fact that globalization and free trade, and therefore also the free trade within the European Union, are becoming weak forces, right? They have become weaker forces to create material welfare. The first attempts of opening up after the Second World War were attempts when the fruit was low hanging in the trees, right? You could easily catch them, and the benefits of free trade were very strong at that time. Now you have to go much higher in the tree to get the fruit, and as a result, the benefits have become less visible, right? That's also why when you ask economists these days about what the effects are of free trade, they can tell you, well, it's probably going to be positive, but we are very uncertain about how positive that is. And when you look at the numbers that have been produced, one can be surprised that, in fact, it's not a great deal, right? So here we are. We have achieved a lot with free trade in Europe and with the rest of the world. But there are diminishing returns to all this, right? An economist know that term of diminished returns. And we have achieved these diminishing returns today. So that's one problem. The other problem has to do with something you know very well, and that is that globalization, while it produces many winners, also produces losers. Since the total pie increases, in principle, it should be easy to compensate the losers and still have something left over. And economists are typically advocating this kind of approach. Since we create material welfare, we should be able to compensate the losers. The problem, of course, is, as you know, is very difficult to do politically. The winners are very adept and at trying to avoid having to contribute, and as a result, this is very difficult. It's even more so in the European Union because the way this whole thing is governed at a European level, and that is that trade, internal market, is a European responsibility, while compensation schemes, redistribution, and social security is at the level of the nation state. And as a result, this creates a first problem, which is that the perception of many people, in particular the perception of the losers, is that Europe is to blame for their losses, right? Because it's in Europe that all this is made possible. And nation states seem to be unable to organize compensation, redistribution, that will make life easier for the losers. In fact, Europe, I think, has made it more difficult, has made things worse, especially in the Eurozone, right? In two ways. First, by imposing since a number of years, but close to one decade now, imposing excessive austerity, right? Austerity means, most of the time, that the losers will pay, right? These are the people who have lost their jobs. The social security system is under pressure, and as a result, they are typically the losers. And in imposing so much austerity while globalization was going on, the European institutions, in fact, helped to punish the losers a second time. And then the other element here is the policy agenda that, especially in the Eurozone again, has been used, which is one of structural reforms, which when you look at the fine print, essentially means that, if there is unemployment, that's because wages are probably too high, so we should be flexible and allow wages to decline. Like in the potato market, right? If there are too many potatoes, you lower the price, and potatoes don't protest, right? But workers do protest when you do that to them, and when you tell that's flexibility. So people will hate flexibility. Structural reforms is also part of, or in the structural reforms, you find all these elements like reducing unemployment benefits, giving incentives to firms to fire more easily. And these are all elements that create enemies, right, among the losers. It's the losers that you hit at a time they are already hit by globalization. And Europe, therefore, has reacted very badly to this problem of losers and winners. It has, in fact, made the loss of those that were hit by globalization even more painful. And we should certainly change that, right? I mean, we cannot continue to do that. Otherwise, we will create so many enemies who will turn to political parties who say, I have a good idea for you. Let's get out of this place. So I think we have to change that before we move forward with more programs for integration. And what do we have to do? Let me conclude with this very, very quickly. We should stop austerity measures, right? We have continued to do that, and as a result, increased the pain for millions of people. And we should also allow public investment to increase. But that has been made very difficult by the very fact that we have imposed a fiscal compact that makes it impossible for governments to borrow when they want to create public investment. And as a result, public investment has gone down, and we have lost a tool that would make it possible to generate more growth today and also in the future. And finally, we should change this policy agenda of structural reforms, right? This has been an extremely destructive policy agenda that, as I said earlier, has created millions of enemies of Europe. And we shouldn't do that. I mean, this is an agenda that may be good for the profits of corporations, but it's bad for too many people who will then turn against free trade. And we'll want protectionism. And we should avoid. I'm in favor of free trade, and globalization. But I do realize that if you want to maintain it in the long run, you have to maintain a social consensus among the people that this is good for them, right? Also, those who today lose, they must maintain the perception that this is something good for them. And that can only be done by creating a fair system, a system that is willing to redistribute, that is to increase taxation on the higher income instead of reducing taxation on the higher incomes. That's what we have been doing in the last 25 years. So therefore, from Europe, we should also be willing to bring that message that we need this kind of redistributive policies. We need policies that put center stage in social security system that allow the losers of globalization to be paid. And we should stop having an agenda, which is an agenda of flexibility and doing things that are very painful for too many people. So that's, I think, what we should do. And I think it's time to stop here. Thank you for your attention.
Thanks, Paul. Much food for thought. Let's now switch to the political dimensions. And Jennifer Jackson, please. I'm sorry.
Thank you very much, Kevin. At this point, I always like to point to the second half of our great name. It is, of course, London School of Economics and Political Science. So I think the movement on to end political science begins with me. When I think about Brexit and when I think about social media, which is the part of Brexit that I've been engaged with, I start from a larger interest in nationalism. And I am particularly inspired in my thinking about social media by the seminal work of Benedict Anderson, Imagined Communities. And for those of you that may have read the book and those of you that remember the book, you will recall that Benedict Anderson noted it was the invention of the print press, the print medium, which allowed the imagining of a nation, a social construct bigger than the very intimate reality of politics that had existed hitherto. We will, in a nation, of course, never meet all of the other members, yet we imagine ourselves to be part of that community, and that powerfully shapes discussions of politics, of legitimacy, and, of course, public debate. But what happens when the print media is no longer as significant as it once was? What happens when we enter a new world where we have digital media and where we have social media? We are, as you know, celebrating 25 years of the European Institute. Cast your mind back 25 years and ask yourself, how would Brexit have happened then? In other words, how would it have been done? Not necessarily the outcome. Whether that would have been different or not, I won't venture to say, but it would have been done differently. I'm a Canadian by origin, so I grew up with referendums. It's a kind of weird deja vu that I've experienced this past year. And if you remember, as I do, the 1995 Quebec referendum or the 1980 Quebec referendum, those debates would have been conducted, and they were conducted, very much in the context of perhaps half a dozen newspapers inside and outside Quebec that everybody would have read. In the context of the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation, the Canadian equivalent of BBC, its radio, its television, and perhaps another dozen radio and television stations inside and outside Quebec. And that would have been the focus of public debate. You would have had press conferences, you did have them, you had public debates, you had campaign material, but it was within a shared and common space. And that is not the way that Brexit happened, at least not exclusively. Brexit began in a very telling fashion, you may recall, by Donald Tusk tweeting. He tweeted, to be together or not to be together? That is the question. And I think that was telling because an awful lot of the way the debate proceeded from then was indeed on and via social media platforms. And when we think about how those platforms operate, we see a very different kind of imagined community playing out. It is an imagined community, of course, that is more fractured. There's a lot of conversation within public debate about the echo chamber effect. And it's certainly true if you ever wish to do what I've been doing, which is to read through 100,000 tweets on Brexit. It's actually more interesting than it sounds. You see visibly this effect. And you can see evidence of the like-minded seeking one another out and then socializing themselves into ever more extreme versions of their original shared beliefs and values. So it has that fracturing effect. It is also uniquely well-placed for populist rhetoric. And again, remember, if you are going to use social media, and politicians today do use social media, as well as, of course, all of us probably in this room, we have a hashtag for the event, remember. When you go on social media, you can directly speak to the public. There is no press filter. There is no editorial control. You are fully free within that space to say what you will. You can be highly emotive, and clearly that too plays into the fracturing echo chamber effect. And again, we see that very visibly through the way that the campaign featured online. When we look at what happened, you can get a strong sense of the Remain position losing online quite clearly, and probably before they lost in the real world. They were slower to move into social media, and they used it less effectively. So you had, obviously, the Leave hashtags establishing earlier. You had far higher volumes of a Leave Twitter. And interestingly, you had, in the savvy use of particularly the hashtags by those on the Leave campaign, a penetration of the Remain discourse. I play around increasingly with the hashtags as a way of thinking about an organized public debate online. And if, again, you look at 100,000 tweets as I've done, what you will see is that the discourse stream of the Remain camp is roughly 75% Remain content. And the discourse hashtag stream of the Leave camp is in excess of 98% Leave-only content. What does that tell you? It tells you something very interesting, because, of course, people choose to use the hashtags, as I hope you're choosing to use our hashtag to publicize this wonderful event. It means, of course, that those who promoted and were sympathetic to the Remain position did not wish to associate themselves with Leave. If I could go back in time and give a whispered hint to the Remain campaign, and I say it to all of you in the future, use the other side's hashtags, because that way you will penetrate the discourse that is trending. You are more likely, in other words, to be seen by the alternate point of view, and perhaps then you will have more of an impact in swaying those who are teetering on whether or not to vote one way or another. So we certainly see all of this. And having lived through Brexit and then having witnessed from afar the recent American election, again, I think you see this very telling shift in the conduct of politics and in the way that the power of social media plays into populism. Does it matter? I sometimes get asked this question. What is the difference? So they lost online, so they used social media. Who cares? Well, I will say to you, you should care. And you should care because, of course, when we have the fragmenting of public space, we are moving away from a shared conversation, from a shared imagined community. We are becoming, in other words, divided. We are being less integrated. And in a plural society, of course, it's incredibly important to have that conversation. Violent discourse online translates into heightened violence in the real world. If you look again at bodies like Tell Mama, they've correlated peaks in Islamophobia online and actual peaks in experienced lived violence in the real world. So these do have direct effects in the way that we're experiencing politics, in the way that we're living our lives, and I believe that they are quite transformative in a disintegrative fashion. So if the nation is being imagined online, it is being imagined in a fractured way. And I think the implication is that we move into a world of many solitudes, potentially, many solitudes, many segmentations, and greater conflict between them, less understanding, more generally, within the public sphere. As I've been looking at all of this, and as a scholar of nationalism and also as somebody who's very interested in minority rights, one of the other key salient points that has become of interest to me is actually the way in which equally demographics plays into this. And again, I look out in the room and I see a lot of people here who are our current students who've come and also our recent alumni, and I speak to them in particular because, of course, they are a part of what is referred to frequently as the millennial cohort, that supposedly does politics differently, is more active online, is more likely to be involved in signing a petition or engaged in another kind of campaign, but perhaps less likely to vote, although this has been challenged in the context of Brexit, where my colleague Michael Bruder actually has said they did vote, and they did vote at much higher levels than were initially suggested. But one of the features that we have seen, and I think this is an important consequence, is the way in which the generational divide has played into this, and a sensibility going forward that this is another key point of fracture which needs to be addressed and which needs to be studied, but also as a point where we at the European Institute can add value into the public campaign. Clearing this with my colleague Kevin, I'm happy to be able to say today that we are going to be launching a public impact project through the European Institute at the LSE, which is intended to crowdsource a millennial cohort vision on the future of UK and EU relations. We have secured the Crowdicity platform that was used to great effect by colleagues in the Institute of Public Affairs for their Constitution UK project, and it has the possibility of having tens of thousands of young people coming together online to discuss their vision of what they would like the future to be, and to discuss it in economics and in politics, and also around values, whether or not this is going to be a cosmopolitan world or something different. So I will hope that all of you will be able to be active within that debate, and we will be able to share that with you online, but equally that we will be using a semi-gamified process of engagement with leaderboards. So actually those who are very prominent online will then be invited back to LSE into real space to engage in further conversation and discourse. And the goal is to be able to produce a millennial vision of what the relationship going forward will be, and it will be sent to the negotiating team on both sides of the table. So we know, of course, that the House of Commons has confirmed the Brexit timeline of the government, and therefore we are planning and should be launching by the end of March next year. So again, this is another way in which I think we can, more positively this time, use digital media, use online media to engage around these issues, and hopefully to give a space for the millennial cohort and for the kind of public impact, public good efforts which the LSE is, of course, committed to engaging in and to supporting. I think I will leave there and perhaps come back to the rest of it in questions.
Thank you.
The European Institute has had a rather good 25 years. As you can see, we have innovative ideas for the next 25 years. So thank you, Jennifer. Over to the government.
You're very
department.
Optimistic about the future, Kevin. Anyway, right. I'm sure it'll be time. Well, first, it's great to be here and to help celebrate the European Institute's 25 years. What I want to do is to look at the impacts of this referendum on UK government and politics. Now, of course, this is all going on in real time. We are now just 5 months on from the vote, nearly 6 months. There's no research about this. Obviously, there's some research about elements of it, but we don't have a deep understanding yet of why all this happened. And I'm not going to dwell too much on why it happened, partly because it was considered here earlier today. But I do want to look at it just for a moment, because this is the most important decision made in Britain since, now choose your date in the past. It's a major historic event. You can put 1688, you know, the execution of Charles I. It is a very, very important moment for the UK and its future, and of course for Europe and its future. I think it's fair to say the British political establishment was completely unprepared, literally not prepared in terms of what to do next, but more than that, emotionally unprepared. And I can't tell you, for those of you and many of you I know do live in Britain or spend time in Britain, but the emotional impact of all of this is profound, and on both sides, both on the Leave side and on the Remain side. And it will remain as a deep, deep fissure in British politics for many years to come. Now, this was touched on this morning, and not everybody was here, so I'll just briefly go through some of the reasons adduced for, they've already been referred to tonight, why this happened, why the Leave vote, this unexpected thing happened, this 52 to 48% vote. First, a rejection of high levels of immigration. Every single unprompted poll taken in the UK shows immigration as the most important issue. It would be naive to pretend otherwise. It's a response, we've heard this earlier this evening, from the economically left behind, both people and areas. Five London boroughs voted to leave the EU, even though London as a whole voted to remain. So it's not just places outside the favoured southeast. Many places in the southeast did indeed vote to leave. It's a dislike of the EU and its cost. I mean, anybody who's lived in Britain or read the British press will know there is a drip, drip, drip feed through from the traditional media, it must be said about this, which was unlikely to be corrected in 6 or 8 weeks of a campaign. It was just there, you know, the straight bananas and they're taking our chocolate and all of that stuff. It had been going on for years. We can't call it chocolate, it was really, wasn't it? And then a sort of catch-all grievance against what are now called out-of-touch metropolitan elites. Kind of people who come to events like this, I suspect, and many of us at the LSE, I fear. But it's against this kind of discourse and this kind, the world in which many of us spend a lot of our time. Now, I wanted to do just a little bit about that of background before moving on to consider the future, because this will change and shape British politics for some time to come. So the rejection of expertise and elites and the British political establishment, and by no means unique to the UK, I think is part of a broader growth of populism, which is now widely understood and is definitely not unique to the UK. It would have been witnessed in other parts of Europe before this happened, and we've seen Donald Trump subsequently. New movements arise, articulating grievances against such elites. UKIP has been brilliant at this. It has one MP in the House of Commons. In fairness, it got a substantial number of votes in the last general election, but because of the first-past-the-post voting system, only got the one seat it had already got by defection. But you have to say, as a movement, it's been profoundly effective, and it now affects the Conservative and Labour parties in the way they speak. So it's been enormously effective by articulating grievances against elites. If there's a failure in any of this, that, by the way, will also be blamed on undermining. You can see that narrative starting already. If it doesn't work out, it's because the elites have undermined what people wanted. This narrative is incredibly strong in the UK media. I suspect even those of you who don't live in the UK will have seen the remarkably articulate front page of one of the tabloid newspapers, which on the day of the High Court judgment, which ruled against the government in effect, it simply had the banner headline in very large type, "Enemies of the People," referring to judges, the judiciary, as enemies of the people. If you want evidence of how far this could emerge into a culture war, then I would suggest that headline tells you how deep things are felt, how deeply this is all felt within the UK. Dozens of books will be written, I'm sure are being written, about this even as we speak. There will be research in future. And of course, the UK is now seen against the backdrop of rising populism right across Europe and indeed in the United States, and of course also the growth of so-called post-truth politics, the idea that you can project ideas that are not true into politics knowingly, and change discourse, change debate, change understanding, change votes. That's a very big new step that others will have to study from now on. Now, this raises a number of huge questions for the UK, for the EU, and indeed for global politics and government. What about within the United Kingdom? Well, the first thing, of course, to notice is that losing the referendum cost David Cameron his job. He'd staked everything on it politically, lost his job, and he's been replaced by Theresa May. I didn't bring a cartoon along this evening, but there is one that I can place in your mind, I think. the chaos that ensued when Cameron resigned and then all sorts of people, Michael Gove, Boris Johnson, others, came forward as potential Conservative leaders, and then some dropped out and stabbed each other in the back, and then the Labour Party kicked off. Were they going to go for yet another, their annual leadership election? And Matt, in the Daily Telegraph, produced a cartoon of two students, appropriately enough, standing outside a university. I looked it up just now to check. And what they were saying to each other was, this was in the middle of it when it was all going on, "I'm studying politics. The course covers the period from 8 o'clock on Thursday morning to lunchtime on Friday." And that's what it felt like at the time. It was an incredibly rapid... Oh, we should do a course on this, shouldn't we? Now I think about it, it's not a bad idea. Anyway, so the big question, seriously, is how to deliver the UK's separation and departure from the European Union after 41 years. We will have to reconfigure, and this has already happened. Whitehall departments have had to be reconfigured very quickly. We have new departments doing this. They've had to be created from nothing. And as Julia Black said, a number of us have been in and out, Kevin and others, to talk to these departments as they've been formed in recent weeks, talking about the school, talking about issues more generally. These departments are good at collecting information and writing briefings. That's what they're doing at the moment. I'm not sure we know yet whether they're going to be as good at implementation, which is a very different thing. Writing big briefings, okay. Implementing and decision-making, much more difficult. The government will have to build new competences, particularly in trade negotiations, something the UK hasn't had to do for years. It's been done in Brussels. This will now have to be done by the UK government itself. There'll need to be new diplomats. You know, some of the relations between the EU institutions and the rest of the world represented Britain. There'll have to be new diplomats as well. And, of course, the need to trigger Article 50 by the 31st of March next year. Now, there's been much discussion recently about the court case, and I've referred to it already, that is going, first it went into the High Court and is now in the Supreme Court in front of 11 Supreme Court judges. You can watch this, I'm sure, even online. It's online, watch it live. I think it's finished today, actually, but you could watch it online, play it back. It's very interesting, I mean, as a process. I'm not sure all of it's very interesting, but it's very interesting to watch it as a process. Theresa May believes she needs to use the royal prerogative to press the Article 50 button. She does not want Parliament taking a vote on it. Why? Well, because if Parliament took a vote on it, they'd amend the conditions and tie her hands. So what we have here in the Supreme Court is, in effect, the government arguing that the Crown prerogative, the Crown, should stop Parliament having a vote. So it is really like a rerun of the English Civil War. There was a vote in Parliament yesterday, but this was a vote, and it was not a binding vote. Effectively, a Labour proposal, a Labour amendment, a Labour proposal, that there should be publication of a Brexit plan before Article 50 is triggered. And that went through with a big majority yesterday. But, you know, a plan could be one line of A4, frankly, or it could be a big document. So I'm not sure what that will turn out to be. The government is trying hard not to reveal its negotiating position. Indeed, they argue that it's absurd to reveal their negotiating position because that would open them up to make it easier for the other side in the negotiations, and I'm afraid they will be the other side, knowing what the UK's position is. So everybody's going to keep their hard cards close to their chest, or the government doesn't really know what it's going to do. It could be either of those things, and we'll find out in due time. Now, this takes us to the key challenge, and I must press on, time is moving fast. The key challenge is that this was a binary vote on a non-binary outcome. That is, that the Brexit winning side was not like a political party in a general election with a nice manifesto. The Brexit coalition, if I can call them that, included free traders and active protectionists. Okay, it included those who are strongly against immigration and those who are actually, in fairness, strongly in favour of it. It included people who are careful about politics and those who enjoy disruptive politics. And that's just three of these oppositions you can single out from them. So Theresa May has to negotiate to keep all of those people and the 48% happy. And this is complex stuff. So, briefly, what are the problems that she now faces? Well, think about this. The government set itself up very clearly, the UK government, as being in favour of free trade. Personally, I'm in favour of free trade, you know, within rules. But it was free trade and globalisation that has damaged the economy and left so many people and places behind. Now, think of the paradox in that. So the very thing that has left many parts of the UK denuded of industry with low-value jobs, that's what we want more of. Now, somebody will have to work that out, because I find that one really quite complicated. Second, immigration is essential to the functioning of the most successful parts of the UK economy. London and the South East is highly dynamic. It has much higher productivity levels than the rest of the UK. 40% of the London workforce is born outside the UK, 40, 40. And in some sectors, it's 65 and 70%. So the London economy is hugely dependent. If that changed radically, so would the UK tax take. And the UK does not have much tax to spare. Third problem, Northern Ireland. Northern Ireland will have an open border, Northern Ireland inside the UK, an open border with the Republic of Ireland, which will remain in the EU. That's going to take much unravelling. Scotland. Scotland is arguing it should have a veto over this process because Britain is now a quasi-federal country. I think the quasi bit is probably not going to help them on that. We're not a federal country quite. But the Scots are arguing that. And then beyond that, you've got the issue that trade deals that are going to be negotiated by the UK government, once Article 50 is triggered, will have different impacts in different parts of the UK. An aerospace deal with the Americans or with the EU will have a completely different effect on the West Midlands than a deal about the City of London will, obviously, which will affect London and the financial services in Edinburgh more. All of that is going to work its way through the system. Now, so far, and we heard this earlier on, in fairness to all concerned, there's been much less bad news than the Remain campaign argued, which doesn't mean it will always be like that. And, crucially, British public opinion in all democracies, can be fickle. It can change very quickly. And so, if things turn to the bad, would opinion change about all of this? We just don't know that. We don't know whether the economic news will get worse, and if it did, we don't know whether public opinion would change. We'll just have to wait to the triggering point and beyond to see that. So finally, just looking ahead, and then I shall stop, 31st of March 2017 is the big date. I think it's going to be very hard for Theresa May, particularly, oddly enough, after yesterday's vote, not to trigger Article 50 then. If she doesn't, I think it would open the whole process to drift. And the drift would be damaging for business. Business wants an end to all of this. It wants it to be all sorted, all to be sorted out. So does the LSE, actually. We need to know the rules under which we're all operating in the future. We just need certainty. So I think Britain will leave the EU. The only question is how. It's partly in the UK's hands, but, of course, mostly in the hands of others. And I'll just leave you with one final thought, and that is this. And this is not unique to Britain and Brexit. It's that the stakes are very high for democracies in all of this. People have voted for change. And the difficulty for those now in charge is what happens if they can't deliver it. Thank you very much.
Well, you came expecting food for thought, and I'm sure you feel that you've been well supplied by a number of interesting, thought-provoking points. In true LSE style, we can now open it up to questions and answers and comments from you. Can I just mention to those people stood up at the back, there are seats available here at the front to take if you wish. So there are colleagues, I think, with microphones. And so if you could simply give your name and then come to the question. Can we take the gentleman at the back here, first of all, please? And then we're going to take the lady here.
Thanks. Ali Miraj from the Contrarian Prize. Why does membership of a free trade area require the free movement of people?
Thank you. That's nice and precise. Could we take the lady here, please?
Simple, it doesn't. Hi, I'm I'm Camina Mortera from the Center for European Reform. I was actually going to ask a very similar question because I've been going back and forth on these free movements, access to the single market question. But beyond that, I was wondering, so far we are heading to a hard Brexit, and that's, in my opinion, down to a lot of miscommunication in between London and Brussels. London is not calling, and even if it was, Brussels would not be picking up the phone. So I was wondering, once we get down and real with the negotiation, will other member states realize that they will also take a hit economically if we have a hard Brexit? And will that change their negotiation strategy?
Who will take the hard, the economic hit?
The EU 27, because we are discussing how the UK would take a hit, but I was wondering whether...
Yeah. Okay, thanks very much indeed. Other questions, if you don't mind? And right at the very back, diagonally across. I'm sorry, this is Antigone, yes.
Hi, Phil Chambers. Just a quick question, if anyone can comment on your thoughts on where things may go with respect to EU nationals resident in the UK, of which I am one, and or reverse. And I suspect this is an ongoing discussion that's taking place as we speak. But to what extent are there thoughts on where that will go, and ultimately the legitimacy of that being a so-called bargaining chip, as we're increasingly hearing from certain quarters?
Okay, thank you. And then if we could take the gentleman here at the front, and then I'm going to come to the table, to the colleagues to respond.
Thank you very much, Francesco Papadia from the Bruegel Institute. I noticed two ironies in the presentation. The first irony is that the suggestion of Paul that Europe should manage globalization better looks to me quite similar to the new line of the Conservative Party under Theresa May. It seems that there is a coincidence between what she said at the Conservative Party and what Paul. So maybe that's just the wrong time to lose the UK from this point of view. The other irony is that contrary to what Paul says, the EU can be seen not as a Trojan horse of globalization into Europe, but as a way to manage exactly globalization by bringing public action at a higher level, increasing the level at the regional level, at the supranational level, which is more capable of managing a global economy. So maybe this is the wrong time for the UK to lose this possibility to bring public governance at a higher level. Thank you.
Okay, thanks. Can I invite colleagues from the table here just to respond to particular points they want to pick up rather than trying to do everything? Ian, would you like to respond to the free trade, free movement question?
A free trade area does not need free movement. But I think what you really mean is, does a single market require free movement? And then Angela Merkel's answer is yes.
Okay. Paul, do you want to respond to the points about
yes,
globalization?
Yes, I think there's more than Angela Merkel here. I agree with Jan's first idea that is free trade and even internal market can be made to work without free movement of people. I don't see essential problems there. The essential problem is the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice in an internal market, because internal market is also... Yes. An agreement about rules that we will all abide with, and therefore we need some referee that must have the jurisdiction to decide whether some country has done it right or wrong. And so it's the rejection of the jurisdiction of the European Court of Justice that makes internal market for the UK a no-go zone, right? If you say, well, we don't accept that jurisdiction anymore, then you set yourself outside the single market. So that, I think that's more fundamental than the free movement. Of course, I'm all in favor, this being said, I'm all in favor of free movement, and in my personal life, I also I'm moving all the time. So I think I can make it clear that, yes, this is something desirable, but it's not something that you essentially need to make free trade workable.
Okay, thanks. And there's also the question, Paul, about...
As
it becomes clear the 27 might take an economic hit, would that rebalance the negotiations?
Well, I do think that the economic hit that the 27 will get from a hard Brexit is a very gentle one. It's not going to be a very bad hit. There is an asymmetry here, which is that the UK will be hit more than the European Union for the very simple reason that for the UK, trade with the European Union is a much larger part of its GDP than the other way around. And as a result, if trade between the UK and the EU is negatively affected, then the hit will be felt more in the UK than it will be felt in the European Union. Okay. This being said, there would still be segments in different countries of people that are very much affected and therefore may organize themselves and lobby for a deal that they believe would be better than a hard Brexit.
Yeah. Okay. Ian, do you want to add on that?
I do. The question for rest of EU or REU or EU27, whatever we want to call it, overlooks the fact that they are not necessarily united. If you are a Polish prime minister or an Estonian or a Lithuanian prime minister, you're concerned about the free movement and about the remittances that come back from your nationals. If you are the minister-president of Land Freistadt Bayern, you're concerned about what impact it will have on BMW, and you will be lobbying very hard, the German chancellor, whatever her name is, to ensure that market access remains full to the UK. But if you're an Italian exporter, seeing that Italian exports go in very small proportions to the UK, you can say, well, we don't particularly care about the UK market. It doesn't influence us that much, and especially when Boris Johnson starts insulting you about selling Prosecco.
Okay. Thanks very much. Jennifer, Tony, do you want to respond to the political questions?
Well, I think I would speak to the point on managing globalization better and actually query whether that in and of itself is enough. Because when I look at this from a perspective of nationalism, a lot of what I see is really a problem in and around integration and social cohesion. And there are a lot of conversations which I think have not taken place, which need to be taken place. One of the things that struck me as a Canadian who hadn't perhaps appreciated the full sense of the regional disparities in the UK, I should have done and I didn't, is the absence of a very prominent public debate around the regional relationships inside the EU. In Canada, we have an extended and ongoing conversation continually around fiscal federalism and federal transfer payments, and it probably sounds very familiar to people who think about the EU. The idea that wealthier regions, in fact, transfer funding to poorer regions, and the notion that this is a reasonable obligation of citizenship and that that wealth should be spread. And I'm struck, following Brexit, by the extent to which that is missing in the United Kingdom, and it perhaps is something that should and could have taken place more effectively, although I defer to my economic colleagues on this point, but equally as well ideas around values and around the ways in which public discourse ought to have happened. There has been an awful lot of accusations on both sides of Leave and Remain around whether and to what extent this is xenophobia, is it racist. Obviously, there is some element of that that is, and it is disturbing. But equally, there are some points, I think, which are important ones that should be reasonably considered around problems of integration, around the difficulties of trying to have a plural society, and we do have a very plural society, super diverse in places, and not wishing that to fall into pockets of segregation where people live isolated lives and they don't engage as fully as they might with others in the community who are very different to themselves. So I think in and around all of these issues, there needs to be more prominent discussion and consideration in public debate and also in public policy.
Thank you.
Tony. If you want to know about fiscal federalism, just look at Belgium.
Okay.
And actually, I mean, the UK does have enormous transfers within, invisibly within the UK, and they are very, very large. But in a sense, you could argue that the highly productive southeastern part, which does transfer huge amounts of tax to the rest of the UK, is the place that nobody's quite found, and the government's now going to have to try to find a way of trying to spread more of the private sector economic activity to the rest of the UK. But just two other points on the EU nationals as bargaining chips. I mean, clearly this is part of the slightly difficult early stages of the negotiating process, but it's hard, and in fact, I think yesterday or the day before, the Home Secretary talked about the idea of some sort of identity cards for residual. It's all being tweeted, so I can say don't quote this, but I think I've got this right. The idea has been floated, it might not have been the Home Secretary. But the idea of some sort of card which would give a right to remain for those who are already lawfully settled. So I think it's very hard to imagine, whatever's being said at the moment, that those who come to the UK and are lawfully settled are going to be sent, as it were, sent back in that sense. And however difficult that turns out as part of a negotiation, I would be amazed if it happened. And frankly, the practicalities of it would be pretty bleak. And then on Theresa May's policies, I mean, I think she has, you're quite right, taken a step towards what you might call a more managed capitalism, certainly rhetorically. And you can tell that by the fact that, you know, true Thatcherites in the Conservative Party don't like it. That's the way of working out what she's signalling. Whether she'll do much about it's another matter. And I totally agree with you that actually I do think the European Union has been an interesting vehicle for, as it were, acting as a compromise agent between globalised trade and markets and the management of all of that. And it is ironic that, in a sense, a response to or reaction to globalisation seems to have been in part one of the reasons why there was a rejection of the European Union.
Good, thanks. Let's take another round of questions. There's a gentleman here at the front, please.
Well, Wiener Luzzoli, an alumnus and resident in Brussels. Let's talk about boundary conditions. And a thought experiment, perhaps, for the panel. Let's assume that in the 1st of March or the end of March, the Article 50 is invoked and a 2 years negotiation takes place. And then after the negotiation, there's no agreement. So nothing is agreed until everything is agreed, usually, in these files. I would assume that in that case, then the UK would be struck off all the books, as in the treaties, the agreements, the programmes and everything else. Who would be the net loser in this scenario, which is not so surreal? And secondly, how would your analysis change in relation to this scenario?
Okay, good, thank you. Can we take the lady in the centre here, please?
Thank you. Eugenie Drussel from Linklaters. My question goes to Dr. Jackson. So you said that the Remain side was not very successful in managing its social media campaign. Could you please explain how they could have managed it better and organized it better?
Okay, thanks. And can we take the gentleman right at the back, and then we're going to take the lady on the right here, please.
Colin Blackman from SEPS. Those who wanted to remain seem to have been getting their knickers in a twist by talking about as soft an exit as possible. But listening to Paul de Grau, one wonders whether there is really that much to negotiate. So that's the question. Is there much to negotiate?
Right, thank you. And then we could take the lady here, please.
Yes, hello. My name is Clara Lemaire, and I'm working for Centrica. My question is related to that first question over there. Is it likely that we're going to have a transitional arrangement at the end of the 2 years? And what could this look like? And could the UK agree on some kind of EEA model on a transitional basis? Or would this be already too much and this wouldn't deliver on the change that they promised to their voters? Thank you.
Thank you. And then final question here, the lady on the left, please. Antigone.
Thank you. My name is Sietske de Groot from TradePeers. I have a question about the single market for services and the digital single market. They are both shaped by and for the UK. These markets are not complete yet. Yet it's vital for the UK, as the UK is an 80% services economy. How do you see the future of these markets? Are they going to be completed without the UK? Is this going to play a role in negotiations? And also, I would like to make a point that I don't agree that the free movement of people is not important, because people are the raw material for the services market.
Okay. I don't think anyone's saying that free movement isn't important. It's just what may be involved in a free trade area. Shall we reverse the sequence and start looking at the politics first and then the economics? Jennifer, there was a specific question of couldn't we have avoided all of this trouble and remain?
Well, I think Remain, if it was going to make more effective use of social media, could have done a number of things differently. First of all, it could have been on social media earlier than it did. The Leave campaign started being very active on social media already quite visibly in the autumn of 2015. So before this all picked up, they had a reasonably clear, organized presence. Remain entered at a much later date, and as a result was seemingly constantly running from behind to catch up. So earlier start, I think, would have been preferable. Equally, in part as a consequence of that, the trending hashtags were dominated disproportionately by the Leave hashtags over and above the Remain hashtags. Now, in part, this is down to a nasty but strategic decision of the Leave campaign to use something called bots. These are the automated tweets, and they use them much more extensively. Leave did as well, but Remain seemingly has used them to far greater effect and higher frequency, coming some of the earlier analysis of this seems to suggest. So if that's the case, then again, better use of bots, despite the legitimacy that one might question the use of them, would probably to have been to their advantage. The other point, I think, is a more general point, and you see it reflected also in the Clinton campaign, just a failure to appreciate the significance of all of this as an instrument of getting a message across. A sense, in other words, that, yes, it was significant to some degree, but that the mainstream message in the mainstream media would be more important, and that the facts and the figures, the more sort of rational political discourse that we would traditionally associate with the mainstream media, would continue to be the most important form of communication. That didn't work out in the way that was expected. Instead, we see very much this emotive populist discourse resonating strongly, and you see Remain capitalizing on that, and you see Trump, I think, even more capitalizing on that. So it may well be that 2016 is the watershed year that really showcases the effectiveness of social media to reach audiences in this way. And I strongly suspect going forward that we will not have disequilibrium in the use of those platforms. I think next time around there will be much better and earlier engagement, precisely because the lesson has been so clearly demonstrated.
Okay, thanks. There were several economics questions. What happens if we don't have a deal at the after 2 years? In any event, what is there to negotiate? And the services sector has been incomplete, but has been very much influenced by British steers. I wonder if you could pick up different parts of those questions. Paul, do you want to begin?
Yes. I will leave the transitional question to you, Ian. Is that fine? It's the most difficult one. Yeah? Is there much to negotiate in the analysis that I've made? I've come to the conclusion that inevitably it will have to be a hard Brexit, that is a trade agreement, a free trade agreement between the UK and the European Union. But that's a hell of a lot of negotiation, right? We know that these trade agreements are very hard. They are now very detailed. Also, it's not like in the past when trade agreements were about tariffs. That was sometimes also very technical, but now the degree of technicality about these things has become just more intrusive, and therefore there will be a lot to negotiate, which also means that it will take a lot of time to come to an agreement, right? This is not in 2 years, but this is likely to take 5 to 10 years, right? That's the type of the kind of horizon that we face, and that will then lead to some transitional arrangements that Jan will be talking about. Let me say one more thing about the future of services. Yes, that's, of course, also part of the hard negotiating dynamics that we will face, because the WTO free trade arrangements up to now have been very limited in the service component and has up to now concentrated mostly on goods. So that is a challenge, especially for the UK. It's much less so for the European Union. For the UK, it's a very strong challenge, given that the service sector in the UK is, proportionally speaking, much more important than it is in most other EU countries, right? When you compare the UK with Germany, for example, it is very striking to find how little industry plays a role in the UK and how important it still is in Germany, and certainly also in France. So that is a real challenge that especially the UK will face, and that will also make the negotiation much more protracted and very difficult to lead to an agreement.
Ian?
Well, I do have to contradict my esteemed colleague here, because the share of manufacturing in France is more or less the same as in the UK, and that makes a significant difference when you're comparing it with Germany, where it's nearly double.
Do you talk about employment or...?
Value added.
Value added, yeah, but that's not a very good measure, huh? Because... No, it's,
you expected debate from the LSE, and we have it straight away.
It's well known. It's because the price of the relative price of industrial goods relative to services declines all the time, right? So you may have the impression that industry goes down, but industry doesn't go down. We continue to produce, but it's cheaper. It's getting cheaper all the time, while services become more expensive. And as a result, in GDP, we attach an increasing weight to services and a declining weight to industry. So that's what I want to say, but
My facts are accurate. I'll start, I think, by trying to answer the question of, would there be net losers if the whole thing came to an end without reaching a conclusion? There is clearly an asymmetry, 27 ranged against one. A small export market for the EU, a big export market for the UK. That suggests asymmetry. But if you allow the expression, Britain may well have a trump card. The trump card is simply saying, we stop Article 50. We're not happy the way it's going. We withdraw it. It would aggravate everybody else enormously, but there's nothing in the treaty provision which says you can't do it, and Lord Kerr, who actually wrote the thing, says, yes, you can end Article 50 at any time. It could be because you have a change of government, it could be because you have a change of heart, or it could be because you want to negotiate in bad faith and just say, stop, start it again. So it's not as easy as saying Britain is in a difficult position. Moreover, I mentioned the point earlier that... there was this potential huge divorce settlement bill. Britain could simply say, we're not paying unless you give us better terms. So there are ways in which Britain has far more negotiating power than appears at first sight that could be exploited. Will there be a transitional agreement or not? Unavoidably, yes, because it's impossible to try to settle all the dossiers that have to be examined within a couple of years, or in fact 18 months if you believe what Barnier is now saying. What is the nature of that transitional agreement? Well, it's going to be all over the place because there are so many chapters that have to be considered. Consider the reverse process of countries joining the EU, chapter by chapter negotiations. It drags on for not just years, probably decades, or in Turkey's case, centuries. That's how long it takes. So there will be some transitional agreements in some areas. There'll be some things that will be settled on time and some will not. They'll linger for the, not so much the divorce negotiations as the post-divorce settlement. On services, there is the paradox that I think what you are getting at is that it's moved in the UK's direction, digital single market and so on, and yet now Britain wants to leave. It's one of many paradoxes that surround Brexit. And here I think that this is worth recalling that a higher proportion of services is non-traded. It's certain major segments of the services industry, particularly financial and business services, that are going to be really contentious. Tourism and others, which are export services, are not particularly going to be affected by Brexit. Indeed, the British tourist sector has won from it because the devaluation of the pound has lured in visitors from continental Europe. So we have to segment the services. It's a huge block of activity. You can't answer questions in it in one sentence.
Okay, however disturbing, even frightening and worrying the topic has been, I'm sure you'll join me in appreciating the presentations that we've had. Before you show the usual applause to our speakers, can I, however, just say a few thank yous? This, I think, has been a great way to celebrate the 25th anniversary of the European Institute. It comes at the end of a day which has been very much an LSE day of different activities. And I would very much like to give just a brief, sincere thank you to the different parts of the school that have made today happen. The Communications Division, the Research Division, Advancements and Alumni Relations, and yes, it's been great to have Julia Black as the interim director here as well. So it's been the LSE day at its best, everyone working together. But yes, you're about to be given a reward, and that is drinks outside. We can continue this discussion over the drinks in the room outside the theatre. But can you please join me in showing your warm appreciation of our speakers?